You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the oldest fossils on Earth with a lead researcher here in Wisconsin. First, as we near the end of the year, we wanted to check in with legislative leaders about the big issues of 2017 and goals for 2018. We'll hear from Wisconsin's Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz, Democrat from Oshkosh, at this time next week. Today, we check in with Wisconsin Senate President Roger Roth, a Republican representing Senate District 19, which includes Appleton. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson spoke with him earlier this week.
The Foxconn deal was certainly a huge topic for several months this year and will continue to be in the news as plans for and construction of the facility move forward. How happy are you with the deal that the state struck with Foxconn?
Yeah, I think the Foxconn deal is going to be great for the state of Wisconsin. I was privileged to be in Washington at the White House in July when the president and Terry Goh and everyone else was there to announce that Foxconn had decided to build a facility in Wisconsin. I think it's going to be transformational. I mean, at the end of the day, what we do in state government is we try and get everything right. We don't really create jobs. We create the atmosphere by which the job creators can create the jobs. And we've been working on tax reform in Wisconsin and environmental reform and reg reform, and we've got it to the point now where a company like Foxconn, which is a global company, could put this expansion anywhere in the world. And they chose us right here in Wisconsin to put that. I think it's significant. I think it speaks volumes to the progress we've made in Wisconsin. And looking forward to watching it bear out is the months and years progress here.
Certainly, this is a huge investment on the part of the state of Wisconsin, therefore the Wisconsin taxpayers. And there are concerns. What happens if the jobs are not created, if Foxconn doesn't build as large a facility or it's a different type of facility? How confident are you that there are things in place that will make sure that this does work well for the state and for the taxpayers?
Yeah, I'm very confident. So the state is putting up an incentive, about $2.85 billion in incentives. The local governments are contributing a certain amount to those incentives as well. But Foxconn will receive from the state, dollars from the state, directly proportional to the amount of infrastructure they put in the ground and the amount of jobs they create. So if they only create a couple of thousand jobs, they won't get the full incentive. If they only create, they're poised to build $10 billion facility. If they only built a $1 billion facility, they wouldn't get the incentives that go towards the entire $10 billion structure. So it's job for, dollars for jobs. They get incentives. They're rewarded the more jobs they create in our state. And I think that's a great way to protect the taxpayer. Because we are not giving Foxconn $2.85 billion. We're rewarding with incentives for every job they create and for every additional infrastructure that they put in the ground.
The state's biennial budget was late getting passed this year. That's not totally unusual. And one of the big issues, transportation funding, still is not really fully resolved. There's still a lot of projects that don't have funding tied to them. There are a lot of questions about where investment is going to go. What do you see as next steps on transportation and other critical infrastructure needs?
Yeah, well, I think the budget clearly identified some differences that there were between the Assembly, the Senate, and the governor. If you look at what we did in the budget, you know, just to hit the high notes, we had some of the largest increases in local road and the bridge improvement program that we've seen in 20 years. We've ensured that major projects like right up here in my district in the Appleton area, the 41 interchange, that those stay on time and on schedule. And then we have the lowest level of transportation borrowing that we've seen since the beginning of this century, so of the 2001-2003 biennium. So those are good things. What we haven't fully realized yet in that whole argument that we see going between the Assembly and the Senate and the governor is a complete and total fix on transportation. I think we've done a great job identifying some areas within the Department of Transportation. Legislative Audit Committee revealed some cost-saving measures that could be implemented there. We've got some work to do with that, and I think what the legislature through this budget was saying was we are going to make sure that the Department of Transportation is operating at peak efficiencies, and I think we're going to get there. When we get that resolved, then the next phase of that will be to look at the transportation project needs that we continue to have the revenues that we have coming in, and then applying the right kind of fixes to make sure that we have the funding there for it. But there isn't an easy solution to it, and I think that probably was bore itself out in the budget process. There wasn't a silver bullet, nor is there, to fix transportation funding. One thing you hear a lot from people is, well, just raise the gas tax. But the gas tax, that's a diminishing return for our state because vehicles are more efficient than they've ever been. That's kind of the future, the way automakers are going. And that means that we'll be getting less, we'll be driving more miles, which is a great thing per gallon of gas, but the state will be capturing less revenue. So we've got to look broader than just the gas tax. And we have to make sure that whatever we do, that it is fair and equitable amongst all Wisconsin citizens.
We're talking with Wisconsin Senate President Roger Roth. He's a Republican representing Senate District 19, which includes Appleton. Let's turn to a national level for a moment, Senator Roth. The Me Too movement has really brought sexual harassment and sexual assault to the forefront. Late last month, Wisconsin legislative leadership from both parties came out to say that the legislature will continue its policy of not publicly releasing information about sexual harassment complaints. Critics say that the public has a right to know about allegations and to feel confident that claims are being handled fairly and effectively. How do you respond to those critics?
Well, first, I would point out that we have released, the chief clerks in both the Assembly and the Senate have released the number of complaints. What they haven't released was the identities of the people who have brought forward those complaints. It is the will of the Senate leadership and Assembly leadership, both Republican and Democrat, and I totally agree with this and support this as well, to make sure that the victims have some rights to privacy here. And I will absolutely support any victim of sexual harassment if on their time frame and their time schedule they want to come forth and identify the nature of their complaints. I will fully support that, but I don't believe that we should do that without without their desire to do that. I think that would put what they call a chilling effect on women and men from reporting sexual harassment in the workplace, and we don't want to see that. We want, what's happening right now with the Me Too movement, I think it is a very good thing. As a parent, as a lot of your listeners' parents with both sons and daughters, you want to make sure that when you send your kids off to the workplace that they don't have to endure some of the things that we're seeing. It's absolutely sickening what some of these women have had to go through, and we don't want to see that, and that's why I think what the movement is uncovering is very good. We do want to stand in our policy here at the state level is to respect the privacy of those individuals who brought forth these complaints. But if they do choose to make those public, I will absolutely support them in their desire to do that.
And supporting them in that way means what? Would you then release the claims that affected them if they say, I want this to be released to the public?
Well, they have the ability to do, if they want to do that, they can do that, and I absolutely support that. What I don't want to do is take someone who does not want that information public. I don't want to force them to relive whatever it is that they went through in public. I don't think that, when you look at the public's right to know versus the privacy of the individual, I think in this instance, the legislature is letting people know of the number of instances, and at the same time, we're protecting the privacy of those individuals, those victims who are involved.
There is a significant tax revision coming from the federal government set to take effect in 2018. How do you think that Wisconsinites will be affected?
Well, I haven't seen all of the details. I know they plan on voting on that at some point this week. I think by and large, it'll be good for the state of Wisconsin. I know for families, they're expanding the child tax credit for that. I know for businesses, they're looking to lower the corporate tax rate, which will put us on a competitive basis. We have the highest corporate tax rates in the industrialized world. It will look to, I believe it'll be lower than the industrialized world at about 21%. So the bottom line is we've needed reform for a long time. I think what they're doing, while it won't make everybody happy, is no tax reform policy will. I do think that it'll benefit our companies and our citizens in the long run.
And finally, as we start to wrap up, Senator Roth, what would you say, looking forward, are your top three priorities for 2018?
Well, we've got a session starting here in a couple of weeks, and we are going to continue to do a couple of things. I've got environmental regulatory reform bill coming forward, something to help out our both our landowners and our developers here, and it centers around wetland regulation reform. We'll be having a hearing later this week in the Senate, and hopefully we'll bring that to a vote here in January or February. But I think it'll be substantial. I've talked to a lot of individuals from around Wisconsin and heard it. You know, they've told me, they said, Senator, if we can do this, this will be the most important thing that Wisconsin's done for business. So we definitely will be working hard on that. There's other reform measures that people are looking to make. They're looking to bring some reforms in entitlement spending. I think that will be significant, too. We have to keep watching what's happening out in Washington. At some point, they are going to take care of the Obamacare debacle. When they do that, states most certainly will play a pivotal role in that, and we could see something if they get tax reform done in December and they're able to do health care reform in the beginning of the year. We might be in for a lot of work here in the springtime here, taking whatever product they give us and making sure that it works in the best interests of Wisconsinites.
Well, Senator Roth, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Wisconsin Senate President Roger Roth, a Republican, talking to Judith Sears-Poisson. We'll hear from Wisconsin Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz, a Democrat, at this time next week. Right now, it's Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Tina Bowling grew up challenged by both whites and Latinos about her identity. Her household identified as Chicano, but she wasn't raised knowing Spanish. She explores that tension in the poem she's sharing with us today and tells us a bit about its creation.
On the road away from my Midwest home, sitting in a cafe on the U.S. East Coast, I order my tea, buy a book, and sit and write a poem. Then Spanish hits me, first like a chirping of pretty tunes, and I love it. I close my eyes for a second. It smells like busy kitchens, crowded streets, and warm smiles. But this is different, because we are on a college campus. This is Castilian Spanish. I laugh at my thought of chirp, chirp. I type, continue on with my poem in English. Soon, my subconscious lays out a welcome mat, as if waiting for this moment. I know if I silently, patiently waited, it would come to me. I chuckle at their teasing, talk of school, professors, wishing I could join them, but knowing I wouldn't. I'm not fluent. They fly higher than I do. Their words transform into a context that can store in my stomach, nourishing the corners left unswept. Undiscovered, I guard them there, won't claim them, because they aren't mine. I am always reminded of that. This isn't mine. They are the breadcrumbs to part of my heritage, one I was blended into, that welcomes my brown hair and eyes, my Latina hips, and hard-to-place facial features, until I speak. I don't speak Spanish. I hardly move nor look up, afraid to disturb this moment, afraid it might fly away. I want to enjoy it in its natural environment, not caged in a novella or recorded in a song. I enjoy the natural rhythm. It plays on my olive-colored skin. La música enters my body, or my body entre la música. No sé, just is. I want to capture this moment. I write quickly and quietly. Tap, tap, tap. They leave. A void enters the room. I am way too familiar with this void. The air falls heavy on my shoulder. I stop writing. Their currents. The thought crosses my mind to toss the breadcrumbs, the same one shared with me, hoping to bring it back. But some things cannot be captured to be enjoyed, only missed. What this is capturing, some of the pieces that you feel like you're missing because you don't quite belong. I'm mixed race, multiracial, and so are you enough of this? Are you enough of that? I felt like I was challenged, you know, and so I would always say, what are the qualifiers? What are the things that make someone more of the side who's German, Norwegian, or more that's, you know, Mexican American, Native American. What does that mean? So those are the elements that are underlying a lot of the experience which is put into this poem. Because when I came up, that I could see, there weren't as many kids who were of mixed race, multiracial backgrounds, and so I felt the pressure to have to identify as one or the other, and you never quite fit. And so, but now I think demographics have changed considerably. To me, that gives me the hope that the dialogue will shift. Everything I write initially is for self because it's a processing tool for me. And then I risk it by putting it out to other people to say, if you find this of use, if this is something that can help you, like it helped me, I share it in that manner.
That was Tina Bowling. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, researchers at UCLA and the University of Wisconsin-Madison have confirmed that microscopic fossils discovered in an almost 3.5 billion-year-old piece of rock are the oldest fossils ever found so far. The piece of rock is from Australia, and this is the earliest direct evidence of life on Earth. John Valley is a professor of geology in the Department of Geoscience at UW-Madison. He's one of the leaders of this study published about the fossils. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So if I were holding these, I'm guessing I would not be aware that I was looking at a fossil. Is that right?
This would be a very ugly black rock. It has fine-grained what looks like graphite. It's mostly quartz, and you can't see a thing without a high-powered microscope.
Now, one of your colleagues in this study has been saying this was a fossil. This is a sign of really old life for some time, but there was doubt out there.
That's right. Bill Schopp and his students had first described the morphology of these features decades ago, and in fact had delineated 11 different taxa interpreted just based on the shapes of these little spheres and rods of carbon. And there'd been a certain amount of pushback on this because it was only shape, and that's not regarded as absolute proof. That's just strongly supportive.
And then how did you try to answer this question here at UW?
Well, another line of evidence, it's actually a fingerprint for life, comes from the geochemistry of the microfossil material. So almost all organic material on Earth today has a distinctive ratio of two types of carbon called isotopes, carbon-13 to carbon-12, which are different numbers of protons, different numbers of neutrons. So the carbon isotope ratio is quite distinctive of life, but there are inorganic ways where you can also get this ratio. They're perhaps not common, but they can happen. And so it has been known for decades also that if you grind up this black rock, you get that carbon isotope ratio that's about right for life. But when you look in the microscope, what you're seeing are these little tiny microbial features surrounded by what was probably just an organic ooze, you know, black icky mud that has now been turned to stone. So there's lots of carbon. You don't know what you're measuring. What we have is a technique that allows us to go in microscopically and analyze in situ just the microfossil. And what we found is that there's a lot more variability than we'd suspected.
Yeah, so this isn't just life that's almost 3.5 billion years old. This is multiple species of life.
The carbon isotopes suggest that we have at least three different functional groups, if you will. We have microbes, bacteria that were photosynthetic, and then we have microbes that produced methane, probably what are now called archaea, and other bacteria that consumed methane. So it was a community, actually a well-developed community of life at this time. This is not the dawn of life. It was already up and going full bore.
And so again, we're talking almost 3.5 billion years ago. This, as I understand it, is way earlier than we used to think life could have started on Earth.
Well, it's interesting. It goes back to an early Wisconsin story, but 50 years ago, the earliest life was pegged at about 500, 550 million years ago in what's called the Cambrian era. And then a University of Wisconsin professor, Stanley Tyler, discovered the first microfossils in a pre-Cambrian rock from the northern shores of Wisconsin. And he pushed, in one paper, he pushed the limits of life back to 1.8 billion years ago. What we're talking about now is twice further back into the first billion years of Earth history, but it's a long tradition of Wisconsin studying these sorts of things.
Is it likely that we're going to be able to find signs that survive of the grandparents of these fossils we're talking about?
A great question. A lot of people are looking. There are a lot of reports by people who have things they think are earlier fossils. And so there are reports of objects that are shaped and the same size as what we report. They have the morphology of life, but no chemistry. And there are other features of rocks that have the geochemical fingerprint, but which don't have the morphology. And so those things go back almost as far as the evidence for the first oceans, back beyond 4 billion years into the Hadean era. And it could be that we'll find evidence that's really definitive in that time frame. But so much of the early record has been overprinted by high-temperature metamorphism.
Now, this is a huge story on Earth. I understand some people are looking at this and saying, if life could have started in these inhospitable conditions in Earth's early history, maybe that's a sign that it's easier to get life on other planets, other solar systems, for that matter, than we used to think.
Absolutely. The evidence suggests that life actually could have formed very quickly. A million years is a long time if you're a living organism, but geologically, that's a blink of an eye. And so it's possible that life formed 4.3 billion years ago on Earth, as soon as the surface cooled down enough to be habitable. And if that's the case, then there's no reason why it couldn't have formed on Mars at about the same time and on the same time frame and on other habitable planets the outside of our solar system.
So you're going to be watching for older and older fossils to be found now?
Well, we're going to be hoping for them, for sure.
Well, John, thanks so much for joining us again to bring us up to date. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
John Valley is a professor of geology in the Department of Geoscience at UW-Madison. He's one of the leaders of the study published about the oldest confirmed fossils found on Earth, the earliest direct evidence of life on Earth, just about 3.5 billion years old. Now, if we're living in the golden age of television, then 2017 is definitely a year worth taking a closer look at. There were TV show comebacks, book and movie adaptations, and new seasons of shows that a lot of us were already addicted to. Angelica Bastian is a critic and staff writer at Vulture. She's here to talk about some of the most popular and iconic shows of the year and maybe some that went under the radar. Angelica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into particular shows, were there any themes you were watching as this year emerged?
Oh, definitely. One theme I definitely noticed with shows like The Handmaid's Tale, for example, was just watching pop culture really reckon with feminism in a very unsubtle sometimes way, using the language of the feminist movement, sometimes directly dealing with ideas of bodily autonomy in a way I found both fascinating and frustrating. I think that was very important to the television we were seeing this year, along with how we're kind of reckoning with nostalgia, both in newer shows like Stranger Things and the revamps or returns of older shows like Will and Grace, for example.
And big picture again, but maybe on a lighter note, I got to say, as I look at people's top 10 lists, I'm kind of overwhelmed. There's so much out there. It all sounds good, and I'm kind of paralyzed by indecision. For someone in my shoes, Angelica, what kind of shows would you point me toward? Not knowing my personal preferences, but what are ones that I shouldn't be missing?
I definitely don't think people should be missing The Good Place. I think that show's amazing. Definitely Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which I believe really evolved this season and is handling mental illness with such honesty that I don't think I've really ever seen in modern pop culture. Those are two shows I very much love. Also, Queen Sugar is an amazing show that I think sometimes falls under the radar a little bit, unfortunately. And Samurai Jack, which returned after a 12-year absence for its final season, and I think was the most stunning meditation on loneliness that I watched this year.
I want to check out one of those shows you just mentioned, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Here's Alyssa.
So he was your first love.
Oh, baby, he was my first everything.
I've thought about him for so long. Those memories are crystal clear. I was so young, he was so big and strong. I can't believe that he...
Oh, so a musical element to that one, I guess. So I got to say, from the title, I thought, oh, this could be really bad, like a funny sitcom with a weird take on mental health. You wrote recently, this is in some ways uniquely a good and realistic portrayal of dealing with mental illness.
Oh, definitely. As someone who has been in and out of mental hospitals, and I'm diagnosed bipolar, and got a fun new additional diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, which was interesting way to end my year. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is completely honest and breathtaking in how it deals with mental illness, and specifically the way women deal with mental illness, and yet somehow is able to skewer this stereotype of the crazy ex-girlfriend and make fun of it, but still remain sincere and very tenderhearted in some ways about the main character's journey. It's a beautiful show. It's probably one of the most daring on television. Also hilarious, and the songs are amazing, which, you know, we just heard a clip from the mid-season finale and had the character Paula played beautifully by Donalyn Chaplin, and her doing a song about her own sort of old obsession that comes to rear its head, so to speak.
And I've got to imagine there are a lot of shows that have gotten mental illness really, really wrong over the years.
Yes, unfortunately.
And did you have misgivings coming into the show? I mean, with the word crazy in the title?
Yeah, I definitely had misgivings. And I was originally a bit colder on the show in the first two seasons. But in watching the third season and sort of dealing with the mental health low point myself this fall, because I was hospitalized right before Thanksgiving and came out, I realized my issues with the show in the first two seasons wasn't because it was mishandling mental illness. It was just cutting too close to the bone. It's surprisingly on point, despite all its very fantastical trappings of also being a musical and dark comedy and referencing everything from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes to like 1980s hair metal bands. It's a stunning show.
Now, you raise another issue that people have been talking about lately. You know, sometimes there's shows where people say, oh, the first season, it's okay, but it gets really good a couple seasons in. But then you're like, there's so much stuff out there. Do I have the patience to hold off till it really hits its stride?
Don't listen to those people, because those people must not have jobs and lives. Personally, as someone who writes about TV for a living, even I don't have time to deal with that sort of wait and see game. I say, you know, give a show a few episodes. If you're not really captured by it, then just kind of put it on the back burner. You can come back to it if, you know, you hear about a particularly great episode. Read some recaps to catch up, and then, you know, maybe give it another try. But I wouldn't burden people with, you know, you have to watch this show. There's very few shows on television I would say that about.
TV writer Angelica Bastian is with us. We're talking about the best TV of 2017. You can share your favorites, the shows you're recommending, the shows maybe you're getting ready to binge watch over the holidays. The number is 888. I should know this number by heart. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Wanted to give you the pledge drive number there. Want to get into another show that you mentioned. This one gets a lot of attention. Here's a listen to the Handmaid's Tale trailer.
I was asleep before. That's how we let it happen. When they slaughtered Congress, we didn't wake up. When they blamed terrorists and suspended the Constitution, we didn't wake up then either.
This show got a lot of attention, Angelica. As I understand it, it's not one of your favorites out there, though.
That's putting it mildly.
So a lot of people like this. What do you not like about Handmaid's Tale?
Where do I begin? So on a completely aesthetic level, the first three episodes, I feel, are very strong. They set up the world in a very fascinating way. They're beautifully shot, beautifully directed by Reed Morano. Unfortunately, the way the show actually deals with feminism, I feel, is both extremely unsubtle, on the nose, and rather offensive, especially with how it deals with the intersections of race and feminism, which is to say it does not really deal with that. You know, in the book written by Margaret Atwood, all people of color are not in this Gilead, this republic that is controlled by crazy white dudes, you know, who want a lot of power and to control women, which is not that far from reality, to be honest. So the show decides to do things a little differently and cast people of color in both minor and important roles, including the best friend character of Elizabeth Moss's main character, which, you know, yes, we all want more diversity within television, but you can't just include characters of color in a show like this and not really handle how including, say, black characters would affect the narrative. It doesn't really consider that, and it treats race as if that's something that could be easily forgotten. And considering how evangelical movements handle people of color, I mean, it's just a really dishonest handling. And okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well,
I was just going to rant.
That's okay. We can move on from Handmaid's Tale, because you've written about 2016 as being a special year for black TV with shows like Queen Sugar, you mentioned, and Insecure. What do you make of 2017 on that theme?
Oh, I'm going to say some somewhat controversial things. I think in some ways we're seeing a lot of growth for black characters on television. We're seeing a lot more, you know, black women and men behind the scenes directing, writing TV. But in a lot of ways, I feel black television isn't evolving in a way that I'm interested in.
How so?
The handling of mental illness, of queerness, of sort of untangling the ideas of this need for perfection that I think every black kid has probably grown up hearing, you have to be better than everybody else in order to even get half as much success. And I feel like the shows are sort of grappling with that in a very strange way in terms of wanting a sense of perfection within these characters that, I don't know, it's not always fun to watch. I like messy characters, but I like an honesty in that messiness. I want more, also just diversity in how we're portraying blackness. I feel like there's maybe more so middle class or upper class black characters. I'm interested in seeing characters who are working poor, but their lives aren't defined by crime. I'm interested in seeing more Afro-Latinos on screen. I'm interested in seeing us in genres beyond, you know, fun, very honest, sort of brazen comedies and very intense, sad dramas. There's more to blackness than that. We're not a monolith.
Angelica Bastian is a critic and staff writer at Vulture. She's talking to us about the year in television. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us what 2017 TV show you binge-watched, you're recommending, following closely. Tell us why you love that particular show. And is there one you think has been a little overrated or overhyped? Call in at 800-642-1234 or, again, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Angelica Bastian about the year in TV. She's a critic and staff writer at The Vulture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your favorite new or continuing TV show of the year? What are you recommending? What are you getting ready to binge watch coming up over the holidays? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard Angelica from Tim on Facebook. Tim says, I wanted to binge watch Twin Peaks, but they doled it out over months. And yeah, you mentioned, or we mentioned earlier, some recaps, some reboots of TV shows. We've got new Twin Peaks this year. What did you think of that?
Oh, wow. I'm now going to have to say this because I've been quiet about it. I'm not a Twin Peaks fan.
The original or the new ones or either?
Both.
Okay.
I mean, I get that it's groundbreaking and important and audacious, but I've just never connected with it. And you know what? It's good to not binge watch everything. Savor the moment. You don't need to watch everything at once.
Yeah. Do you think it's hurting TV, this impulse to want to binge watch everything?
I wouldn't say it's hurting TV, but it's definitely changed our relationship with TV and how we even critique it.
I want to go to our callers now. We'll start with Tony on the line in Egg Harbor. Tony, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Angelica.
Hello.
Well, I guess on that note, I have been binge-watching the show Last Man on Earth. And it's a Hulu distribution. Angelica, do you have any opinions on it?
Nope.
You haven't seen that one? That's the thing. There's so much.
No, I've seen a few episodes.
Oh, you have seen a few? Okay.
It's one of those shows I gave a shot, didn't connect with, and I was like, I have a lot of other stuff to watch.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But you're a fan, Tony, it sounds like?
I think it's the funniest, most poignant, campy, original thing ever written.
Oh, wow.
But in a nutshell, it's there's a virus that wipes out the entire planet,
mm-hmm.
and there's a handful of people that are saved. Mary Steenburgen is one of them, but the rest are really, you know, they're not notable cast members. Will Ferrell played a cameo role, and it really hits every button on human nature and behavior and greed and jealousy and anger, and I'm just telling you. And I think the writer came from Saturday Night Live. So.
Tony, thank you so much for sharing that. And actually, that reminds me of another point I wanted to bring up, Angelica. He's talking about this is a comedy, but it's hitting on all the points of human nature. You mentioned The Good Place earlier, mm-hmm. which I have watched. And it's hilarious, and it's a philosophy lesson. The Last Samurai you wrote was this meditation on, I think, loneliness. We're getting entertained. We're also getting a lot apart from that entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes shows like Samurai Jack and The Good Place can really surprise you with how they deal with some very heady, intense themes and ideas about human nature, which you wouldn't expect in shows that seem so bright and fun on the surface, at least.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Paulina in Sun Prairie. Paulina, hi.
Hi. Hello. Hi. I listen to the show all the time, and it's very amusing what you guys talk about.
Thanks.
I think it's very important for people to hear. But I stopped watching TV a little bit because, I mean, I see some of the black characters and actors and actresses or whatever, they have to play like gay characters or either they have to be on drugs. Like certain TV shows I watch, like Suburban Housewives and Empire, I stopped watching all of that because all the black characters have to be gay or either on drugs, and I don't like that. It's okay if other people choose to be gay, you know, that's their preference. But I feel that they shouldn't have to continue to push it down our throats because it was never like that. You know, it was never pushed at us like this as it is now than it was, you know, years ago.
Paulina, thanks for the call. So she's seeing people, black actors being slotted into just a couple different types, I guess, Angelica.
Yeah, I mean, personally, what I will say is, as a queer black woman, I'm very happy to see more queer black characters on screen, and I hope to see that continue to happen. For me, I think we should have a diversity of experiences when we watch black characters. I don't think it's shoved down our throat. Personally, I am very happy to see more queer characters on screen.
We're talking about TV in 2017. Angelica Bastian is with us. She's a critic and staff writer at The Vulture. Let's give a listen to a clip from the second season of Stranger Things, another show that a lot of people are talking about that I haven't seen. Here's the character Will telling Mike about a scary supernatural sight.
And there was this noise coming from everywhere. And then I saw something.
Demogorgon?
No. It was like this huge shadow.
And people point toward the nostalgia in Stranger Things. Is that part of the theme you were talking about earlier, Angelica?
Oh, definitely. Stranger Things is obviously very interested in the 80s in terms of the pop culture that was released. And again, in terms of the pop culture that was released. That's pretty much it with that show. I am not a fan at all.
Yeah,
yet I've seen the whole second season.
Because you have to, or was there something that kept you going in it?
I don't even know. Who knows? I was just sitting down with my cats, and I was like, why not? And then I looked up, and I'm like, oh, wow. Oh, it's done? Okay.
So the cats liked it anyway.
The cats loved it.
We'll go back to our callers now. Jack is on the line in Eau Claire. Jack, hi.
Hey.
What do you have for us, Jack?
Well, my favorite show over the past year or two is called Detectorists. It is a BBC comedy. It's about two guys that go out metal detecting together. Pretty simple, funny show.
It's a comedy mainly?
Yep, it's pretty, yeah, it's your typical really dry British humor.
Okay, Jack, thanks a lot for sharing that. Again, so much out there. I don't know what all the BBC is doing these days. Angelica, anything else maybe off the beaten path that you're liking that, you know, isn't getting all the buzz these days?
Well, I would definitely say, besides what I've already mentioned, Claws was a really good show. Good Behavior is amazing, and I love a good pulpy, female-led, sort of dark, but still willing to be fun and enjoy the what makes pulp so fascinating and what makes certain versions of crime dramas really fascinating, which is watching beautiful people mess up in fascinating, messy ways. Beyond those two shows and Samurai Jack and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which I already mentioned, I really enjoyed Humans, which is actually, I think, a BBC show. And it deals with basically robots who gain artificial intelligence and are very lifelike. It's like Westworld, but way more interesting and subdued.
And you mentioned Claws, which you had written about, and I saw some other people mention. That one was new to me, so I missed that this year. Tell us a little more about that.
So that's a summer show that takes place in South Florida and is led by Niecy Nash, who plays the owner of a nail salon who is pretty much a front for laundering drug money, and things turn topsy-turvy very quickly. And, you know, on the surface, it's very brightly colored and fun, and Niecy Nash's performance is amazing, but it's also a very sincere show, especially when you start to look at how it deals with the idea of families, both those that we're born into and those that we make.
Let's bring on another caller now. Fawn is with us in Madison. Fawn, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say, I was surprised you didn't mention Blackish among Black, you know, written and starred shows. That's still a winner in our household. We also, my husband's a sci-fi buff, and we started watching The Orville, which is, in our opinion, like, takes the best of the spirit of Star Trek and keeps it going, just reinvigorates it. It's very clever. It's very, well, it has a good heart and humor. And so it's like a good combination of all those things for the kind of a continuation of the Star Trek type of legacy. But Fawn, also Black, I just want to say Blackish is a winner for us.
Fawn, thanks. Any thoughts on Blackish and or The Orville, Angelica?
I think Blackish is actually a pretty good show. It's just one I don't necessarily always connect to, and I think it's, again, sort of comes down to class dynamics. It's a great show. It's fun. Tracee Ellis Ross continues to kill it in her performance on that show, but not one that really captures my heart, so to speak. But I will say, I thought it was interesting she brought up The Orville as continuing the tradition of Star Trek, especially now that we actually have a new Star Trek show on TV, Discovery. Well, sort of, I guess. CBS All Access,
right,
more so than actual TV. Oh, it's so weird nowadays. I don't like either of those shows, and I'm a huge Star Trek fan.
Okay.
Huge.
Well, Angelica, just briefly as we wrap up, anything on your radar for the new year that you're like, you can't wait for?
That's a good question. I'm mostly looking forward to certain shows returning. I'm very curious to see how Crazy Ex-Girlfriend continues the third season. It's now on that mid-season hiatus that shows like to do. And so that's one that I'm definitely really curious to see. Also, The Alienist. I'm curious about that one as well.
Well, Angelica, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Angelica Bastian is a critic and staff writer at Vulture. She joined us to talk about the year in TV. Still time to share some of your favorites over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.